going to start by asking if any of you can tell me when stones are first mentioned in the Bible. Nobody knows?
Genesis 41.
No.
I was going to say,
how did you get down there? If there's an earlier Genesis.
I don't know. Let's see if the earlier Genesis is on there.
Gifts and tokens of friendship is the first hint. All right.
Genesis 2.
Right! Ah, you go to the head of the class. Right in the very beginning, right in the creation. In the Garden of Eden, right from there. It's the beginning of the mention of gemstones. And they're scattered all through the Bible, right down to the next to the last chapter in Revelation, which is the big finale, really, of the gemstones. And, of course, that is projecting ahead to the holy city and into eternity. God uses symbolism. And he uses symbolism of precious stones as an expression of the beauty and the durability of his eternal love. And this comes out as you really start studying and reading the various references. You know, in the first chapter of Genesis, we have a concise capsule description of the 6 days of creation. Then in chapter 2, God blesses the seventh day, and then follows more specific description of creation in the Garden of Eden. And I'm going to read Genesis 2, verses 8 through 12. I wish this book wasn't so heavy. Yahweh God planted a garden in Eden, which is in the east. And there he put the man he fashioned. Yahweh God caused to spring up from the soil every kind of tree, enticing to look at and good to eat, with the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil in the middle of the garden. A river flowed from Eden to water the garden, and from there it divided to make 4 streams. The first is named the Pishon. And this encircles the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold. The gold of this land is pure. Delium and onyx stone are found there. We have some onyx stone. There are actually 2 kinds of onyx stone. This is the calcite onyx, which is softer, would be easily carved. This is the quartz or agate type that is really called sardonyx. And I think in some translations you have sardonyx used. They make cameos out of it. Now, in the account of creation itself, it's brought to our attention. See the inclusion of precious metals and aromatic resin. Delium today is an aromatic resin, and it's quite reasonable that this was not intended to be considered a gemstone. I think they're still debating this one. Some think this might be a form of quartz. And the gemstone. And as God created, he saw that everything was good. Here is mention of things of beauty, perfection. The gold was pure gold. Durability, worth, value. Did you know that the term precious stone is an original Hebrew expression? And it has come into the English language through the biblical translation. It's listed 14 times in the RSV. And also we have such terms as costly stones, stones of setting, stones of fire, precious stones, precious jewels, most rare jewel, fine jewel, fair jewel, stones of remembrance. So our attitude, our feeling for rare, rich, precious, things of great value, the mark of distinction, comes down to us from the ancients and from the Bible. And according to Pliny, who died in 79 AD, gems are the concentrated beauty of the world. However, it was probably not aesthetic appreciation that motivated the earliest people in acquiring and preparing and wearing stones. It was probably the desire for ornamentation, something to adorn themselves. The Egyptians contributed magical properties to gems, but none of this is in the Bible, with the exception of the term amulet, which means charm. As the ancients acquired personal property, gemstones served the need of an identification, such as the use of seals and scarab on documents, especially if the person couldn't write. And then gemstones were safe investments, and sometimes I've known of people who have invested in gemstones instead of in bonds, even today. But for the ancients, it was a way to conserve great wealth. There was little fluctuation in the value. They were readily sold if they needed to barter, or if they needed money. They were light to carry around. They're small, easily hid away. And some wore their wealth, and still do. In Ecuador, in South America, the Otavala Indians, the women wear their wealth. You can tell how wealthy a particular family is by the number of red and gold colored beads she wears around her arms and around her neck. Some of them will be just really blanketed with them. And I decided I wanted to acquire a string of each of the red and the gold color to bring home, and I found they sold by the bead and not by the string. They were really worth something, although they just looked like glass beads. They weren't of real gold. Now I lost my place. Where am I? Here I am, down here past the Egyptians. Safe investments, yes. Well, if we consider the numerous references to separately named jewels, the part played by gemstones in the Old Testament literature appears to be as remarkable and as significant as jewels themselves seem to have been to Bible people. And that brings us to our list here on the blackboard. We have jewels used for personal adornment, and we have a number of references there which you can write down and look up at your leisure. Gifts and tokens of friendship. In 1 Kings chapter 10, we have the Queen of Sheba bringing a camel train load of gold and spices and gemstones, and it was said that there had never been or never was again as large a quantity of spices brought into Israel as she brought to King Solomon. I think that's also covered in 2 Chronicles 9. And we have the royal crowns, references, royal garments, royal treasury, royal sanctuary, and the high priest insignia, which we'll spend a little more time on. But none of these are really the main five lists of the Bible. The Old Testament jewelry, we have mention of signet rings, anklets, and foot chains, and I'd like to know what the difference is between anklets and foot chains. Did they wear chains between their toes or something? Amulets, armlets, bracelets, belts, tiaras, pendants, crescents, earrings, and nose rings. And quite a number of these are covered in Isaiah 3, verses 19 to 21. Have any of you visited King Tutankhamun's exhibit?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
King Tut?
Yeah.
Some of you did. What did you see there?
All kinds of jewels, lots of gold, and quite a lot of jewels set in the gold.
Right. Did you see the golden tomb mask that was inlaid with lapis lazuli,
yeah,
obsidian, quartz, carnelian? This is lapis lazuli. It comes from northern Mesopotamia, and also Chile has some. But I think the lapis from Mesopotamia is of a better quality. The Chilean lapis is a little lighter. Here is a cab that's in process, but you can kind of see from it the way to detect true lapis. It has a touch of iron pyrite in it that gives that little silver glint. And if somebody tries to sell you a blue stone and calls it lapis and it doesn't have that little glint, don't buy it. Carnelian is quartz. Well, carnelian is a form of quartz. It's the red, reddish-brown quartz. This is what it looks like in the rough, the way it comes out of the ground. This is a rather thick slab of it. We don't have a close enough light here for you to get the translucence. Perhaps you can. But we've tumble polished quite a few. We get quite a few of the carnelian stones in this size from Uruguay. And so
there's some of that here too?
Carnelian, yes, there's in the state of Washington over near Chehalis.
Mm-hmm.
You can dig quite a bit of carnelian there. In Oregon, go to Lebanon. Most of your agate types are quite plentiful. And you wonder then, why were they considered precious to the ancients? But I think you'll understand better as I get on in this. Also, if you noticed, the ancient form of polishing, what type of stones that you saw at King Tut's exhibit, the shape of them. They were not faceted, were they? They weren't cut like a diamond. Mm-hmm. More, the cabochon, the rounded head, the smooth rounded top and smooth sides, the thick rounded head. This isn't very thick. Here's a cabochon on a dop stick that's been polished. Or the settings in your rings.
What is the term you're using? Here is a what?
Cabochon. Cabochon.
Would it be possible to pass that around?
And if it's... Well, I thought I'd let people come up afterwards and look, because I may want to refer to them again then. And maybe a little later. The word is a French word. And when Natalie's father was here, and he was down in the lapidary, and he took exception at my English pronunciation of the word cabochon. And I do not have a good nasal French, but cabochon. And it means, he said, a thick head. So I could understand then why we call this type of jewelry a cabochon. But at any rate, you'll note that the technique that we use over there in the lapidary is very, very ancient. We go right back to 3,000 years. We're not that that was intended so, but it just happens that that is the beginner's lesson in gemstone cutting. And faceted stones, like your diamond cut, came much later. It's quite a recent European technique. You know, in the King James Version, there are no less than 102 specific stone references. And if we could count the references to gold and silver, I don't really know how. I think it would take a computer to dig that out of the scriptures, because gold and silver are just mentioned so many, many times. Now, it's intriguing to us today to try to identify the precious stones of the Bible with the names of those that we have today. But we have to remember that the present science of mineralogy, with its names and its chemical formulas and its rather exact terminology, it's a young science, and it's younger than physics or chemistry or astronomy or even mathematics. And so we don't know in all cases when a mineral name is used in the Bible if it's used with the same meaning as that expressed in our modern mineralogy. Because our modern mineralogy, each of these stones have a definite chemical composition. And that composition, we can take this crystal. This crystal came from Vesper Peak. This crystal came from the Olympic Peninsula. I don't know the location of this crystal, but they are chemically all silicon dioxide. They are the same, no matter where they came from. This, too, is silicon dioxide. It's the massive form of silicate. So we have a definite terminology. We don't know how they named them, or whether when the people were writing when the translators were writing the Bible, if they had a way of really, well, on some minerals you can. Water is a mineral, for example, and there's no question about water. A diamond, I don't know whether people in the Holy Land had access to diamonds yet, because they weren't discovered in Africa that early. The big finds were in Brazil first, and of course they might have had access even from Brazil, it's possible. But there isn't as much mention of diamonds as I used to think there ought to be. But now I understand better that they may not have had access to them at that time. Well, in other words, what was precious to them may not necessarily be what is precious to us today, because we've had the whole world to mine. There have been new finds and new stones.
Ruby was a big one in
yes.
those days, and it's not
yes.
such an expensive stone today.
No.
But not to mention maybe ruby.
It really, really doesn't matter. Because I think what does matter is to know how they used the symbolism, the way they used the precious stones, the terminology in the scripture. I think another example of what is precious one place isn't necessarily other places. Here in the state of Washington, we have a stone that is called the Ellensburg Blue because it's found near Ellensburg. It's a very beautiful form of agate that is almost an opal and often has white lines and shadows in it, so that when it's worked up, it's very beautiful. But it isn't worth a thing in New York. You take it to some other part of the country, and it really isn't, it isn't worth anything there. So this is something to think about in the way they looked at it and the way we look at it. The geological surveys of the Palestine-Syria area show no noticeable gemstone deposits. The Israelites didn't have a place to mine gemstones. On the other hand, Egypt has 15 kinds of precious stones and 6 in more than one site. And northern Mesopotamia, it is a name, Mesopotamia, has native deposits of 4 gemstones that the ancients count as precious, and I think lapis lazuli is one of them, as we still get it from there. Now this bears out then that the Israelites received their precious stones from other lands and people, and since they were imported, therefore they were rare and they were also expensive. Generally, the jewels came through regional distributors, especially the Phoenician traders and seafarers. You pick this up in Ezekiel chapter 28, verse 13. The Arabs had a lively trade down the eastern coast of Africa, as far as Tanzania, Zanzibar, and there is documentary evidence of a very close-knit network of Indian Ocean trade, and ships from India traded with Eastern Africa and also Egyptian ships. Now this is about the time of Christ, but shortly after this particular document came, was written by an eyewitness, and the Egyptian ships arrived in at Zanzibar, what is now Zanzibar, it was called the Land of Zanj then, in July. And I don't know when the ships from India came, but you can see how green quartz, which is mentioned in some of the translations, or green jasper rather, mentioned in some of the translations, could wet that to get a better idea of the color. Jasper comes in all colors, incidentally. And this is what we call the India bloodstone, because it has those little flecks of red. But it could have gone by Indian ship to Zanzibar, and the Egyptian ships picked it up there, and the Phoenicians traded with the Arabs. And you can see how these things can get around, but you could also see how expensive they'd become by the time they got to their final destination, and why they would consider such things precious. Because jasper is referred to as definitely as a precious stone, and jasper to us is quite common. You find it everywhere. Not in Holden Village, but I'll put it this way, you find it in just about every state in the Union, and you find it in most countries. The Israelites, you remember, did receive an early quantity of gold and silver adornments from Egypt when they were freed from slavery there. I always wondered why, I often thought about this, God telling them to go to their master or their mistress and ask for a gold ornament, a bracelet or something to wear to take with them. And I used to wonder why he did that. And now it begins to make sense. This was their severance pay. They were negotiable. This was a negotiable item that they could take with them, maybe to trade with some of the tribes or places where they were going along the way, or things. And also, you remember I mentioned before that the Queen of Sheba had brought this tremendous gift to the Israelites. So we have evidence of these two places where they acquired gemstones and gold and silver and the precious things by gift. But the archaeological Palestinian excavations do not reveal many jewels, except the 15th, 14th century BC collection found at Megiddo, some finds at, is it pronounced Gezer? Gezer? G-E-Z-E-R. Gezer? Gezer? And Ezion Geber? Geber? Somebody? You Bible people? Well, anyway, they found carnelian, agate, alabaster, and glass beads. They did find some deposits there. But you know, I wonder if the Israelites that got these gems from the Egyptians, the jewelry from the Egyptians, you suppose that they got that as far as the promised land? Because the first generation didn't make it, did they? It was the second generation. So maybe not too many of that supply of jewelry got to Israel.
Well, you got to deal with the golden calf yet. Yeah.
That's right.
Besides that, they built the ark for what was left, so I don't know.
That's right. They melted it down, didn't they? They collected there, and Moses was so mad at them. Well, by contrast, with the lack of gemstones that show up in archaeological digs in Palestine, we have engraved gems with elaborately tooled vessels of gold and silver among the common surviving Phoenician products. And we've seen in the exhibits the richness of Egyptian tomb collections and engraved jewels in Greek excavations trace a whole panorama of Greek art style, by contrast. There is also evidence that foreign merchants had factories in Samaria in King Omri's time, and he was the sixth king of Israel at about 886 to 874 BC. Now, it's possible the Israelites might have learned the art of gem cutting and polishing when they were with the Egyptians. I'm more inclined to think that they may have learned it later from foreign merchants. But at any rate, the stones would have been imported to Israel, and they would remain rare and quite expensive. And the craft of cutting and polishing developed, however, in Israel. Even though they didn't have any gemstones of their own and these were expensive, the craft developed there and it's still in existence there today. In fact, it's one of the things that they are rather proud of, and they also cut diamonds in Israel today, in Tel Aviv. Now, gemstones carried more significance in Bible days than they do now, because to the ancients they were a mark of wealth, power, prestige, perfection, something really special, really remarkable, and hard to get. And this kind of follows on through in various countries, the crown, jewels, the gems of a royal scepter, the ultimate. And indeed the ultimate, because God apparently thought along the same lines when He prescribed the design of Aaron's breastplate. Now there is a list of five principal precious, say that differently, the five principal lists of precious stones in the Bible include the high priest insignia, Job's wisdom list, Isaiah 54, 7 to 17, which I call the promise, and Ezekiel's list of the city of Tyre, and then in the New Testament, the holy city. And we'll talk about these for a minute. I think I'll read in in I've gone too far here, it's in Genesis. Exodus chapter 28. God is talking to Moses, and I'm going to just pick spots here. And he says, from among the sons of Israel, summon your brother Aaron and his sons to be priests in my service. And then on down, he refers to the vestments to be made. These are the vestments they must make: the pectoral, the ephod, the robe, the embroidered tunic, the turban, and the girdle. And jumping down to the ephod, which I gather was a vestment that had a belt fastened around the waist and it had shoulder straps, and the Aaron's breastplate was fastened to this. And he said, you will then take two onyx stones and engrave them with the names of the son of Israel, six of their names on one stone, the remaining six on the other, in the order of their birth, with the art of a jeweler, of an engraver of seals. You are to engrave the two stones with the names of the son of Israel and mount them in settings of gold mesh. You are to fasten the two stones commemorating the sons of Israel to the shoulder straps of the ephod. In this way, Aaron will bear their names on his shoulder in the presence of Yahweh so as to commemorate them. And then we jump down to the pectoral of judgment. You are to make a pectoral of judgment, finely brocaded, of the same workmanship as the ephod. You are to make it of gold, purple stuffs, violet shade and red, crimson stuffs, and fine twin linen. It is to be square and doubled over, a span in length and a span in width. In this you are to set four rows of stones: sard, topaz, carbuncle for the first row, emerald, sapphire, diamond, the second row, hyacinth, ruby, amethyst, the fourth row, beryl, onyx, jasper. These are to be mounted in gold settings. They are to bear the names of the sons of Israel, and like the names on them are to be 12 in number. They are to be engraved like seals, each with the name of one of the 12 tribes. And jumping down to verse 29, thus, by means of the pectoral of judgment, when Aaron enters the sanctuary, he will bear the names of the sons of Israel on his breast, to call them to mind continually in the presence of Yahweh. Now, the Israelites, I think, should have been impressed. When God had the high priest enter the sanctuary to stand in his presence, he didn't bring in a scribbled note or a typewritten sheet or even a scroll of papyrus. What did he bring? He would stand there with stones that were rare and very hard to get. In the minds of the Israelites. So they were really symbolized, the tribe symbolized, as precious jewels. And they were even to be scribed with the art of a jeweler on each stone. Here again he's using symbolism to impress us with the beauty, the durability of his everlasting love and concern for his people. I'm going to move on to Job's wisdom list, and I covered that in the Matins not long ago, so I'll just capsulize it here. Here is again Job is saying, man digs mines in the depths of the earth and he's searching for every precious thing. But where does wisdom come from? And where is understanding to be found? And then comes the list of precious stones. Gold is mentioned 5 times. These other stones are only mentioned once. Precious onyx, sapphire, gold, gold vases, coral, crystal, pearls, and topaz. Some translations have ruby in there too. But none of these stones could purchase wisdom, or could they even match it in its value. And only God has traced its path. God answers. Wisdom, it is the fear of the Lord. Understanding, the avoidance of evil. We'll move on to Isaiah 54. I liked this when I found it, because here is God's reassurance to all of us that even though we may do things that he might be angry with us, he does forgive, and he eternally loves us. Here in starting with verse 9, and I'm going to be skipping over verses. I did forsake you for a brief moment, but with great love will I take you back. Now, God is talking to Isaiah, to the Israelites, I believe. But my love for you will never leave you, and my covenant of peace with you will never be shaken, says Yahweh, who takes pity on you. Unhappy creature, storm-tossed, disconsolate, see, I will set your stones on carbuncles, garnets. And your foundation on sapphires. There's some in the little sack there. I will make rubies your battlements, your gates crystal, and your entire wall precious stones. Your sons will all be taught by Yahweh. The prosperity of your sons will be great. You will be founded on integrity, remote from oppression. You will have nothing to fear. So he may seem to forsake us, but his love will never leave us. His covenant of peace will never be shaken. And again, the use of symbolism of the gemstones. Here, almost a touch of the New Jerusalem. You will be founded on integrity, and I like that. And that leads me to another one, a verse that I like very much in Isaiah 61:10. I exult for joy in Yahweh. My soul rejoices in my God. For he has clothed me in the garments of salvation. He has wrapped me in the cloak of integrity. Like a bridegroom wearing his wreath, like a bride adorned in her jewels. But I like that. Clothed me in the garments of salvation and wrapped me in the cloak of integrity. The fourth of the lists, of the major lists, is in Ezekiel. And this is a, there are a couple of chapters here I missed that really puzzle me. God, whereas these others have all been positive, this one is in the negative. And God is speaking through Ezekiel, presumably to the king of Tyre. Is it pronounced Tyre? But the text seems to really be directed at the city of Tyre, and yet there's some things in it that make it almost sound like you're describing the fall of Satan. And to me, it's a bit confusing. The city of Tyre, it has grown rich and beautiful, a thing of splendor. It's decked in precious jewels until it became swollen with pride, corrupt, and to be destroyed. And to read just a few lines of it. You were once an exemplar of perfection, full of wisdom, perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, in the garden of God. See, how is he directing this at the king of Tyre, you see? That's what has me kind of puzzled. And yet, he seems to be talking about the city. The city has gone corrupt. 1,000 gems formed your mantle. Topaz, or sard, topaz, diamond, chrysolite, onyx, jasper, sapphire, carbuncle, emerald, the gold of which your flutes and tambourines are made. All were prepared on the day of your creation. I had provided you with a guardian cherub. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked amid red-hot coals. Your behavior was exemplary from the day of your creation until the day when evil was first found in you. Your busy trading has filled you with violence and sin. I have thrown you down from the mountain of God, and the guardian cherub has destroyed you from amid the coals. Your heart has grown swollen with pride on account of your beauty. You have corrupted your wisdom owing to your splendor, and it goes on and on. But that one has long puzzled me as to who God was really talking to, or is he talking to the king of Tyre, the city of Tyre? Oh. We get into the New Testament. I haven't found a lot of jewels in the New Testament, mainly pearls. And Jesus used pearls as the symbolic jewel. In Matthew 7:6, you recall, he said, "Do not cast your pearls for swine to trample on them." And in Matthew 13, verses 45 and 46, Jesus said, "The kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he finds one of great value, he sells everything he owns and buys it." In 1 Timothy 2, verse 9, there's another reference to pearls. Also in Revelation 17, 4, and 18, 12, and 21, 21. When we get to Revelations 21, this now brings us to the fifth and the final list. In the end of Revelation, we have the beautiful finale, the culmination, the goal for which we are all alive and living. It's the promise, the proclamation fulfilled, the New Jerusalem, the holy city arrayed in splendor and glory beyond our conception. And I think you have to read it. Appreciate it. I'm starting with verse 9 in chapter 21. One of the seven angels that had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came to speak to me and said, "Come here and I will show you the bride that the Lamb has married." In the spirit, He took me to the top of an enormous high mountain and showed me Jerusalem, the holy city, coming down from God out of heaven. It had all the radiant glory of God and glittered like some precious jewel or crystal clear diamond. The walls of it were of great height and had 12 gates. At each of the 12 gates there was an angel, and over the gate were written the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. On the east there were 3 gates, on the north 3 gates, on the south 3 gates, and on the west 3 gates. The city walls stood on 12 foundation stones, each one of which bore the name of one of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. Now notice the difference here. Over the gates were written the names of the 12 tribes of Israel, but on the foundation stones were engraved the names of the 12 apostles, one on each stone. The angel that was speaking to me was carrying a gold measuring rod to measure the city and its gates and wall. The plan of the city is perfectly square, its length the same as its breadth. He measured the city with his rod, and it was 12,000 furlongs in length and in breadth, and equal in height. He measured its wall, and it was 144 cubits high. The angel was using the ordinary cubit. The wall was built of diamond, and the city of pure gold, like polished glass. The foundations of the city wall were faced with all kinds of precious stone. The first was diamond, the second lapis lazuli, the third turquoise, the fourth crystal, the fifth agate, the sixth ruby, the seventh gold quartz, the eighth malachite, the ninth topaz, the tenth emerald, the 11th sapphire, and the 12th amethyst. The 12 gates were 12 pearls, each gate being made of a single pearl. And the main street of the city was pure gold, transparent as glass. I saw that there was no temple in the city, since the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb were themselves the temple. And the city did not need the sun or the moon for light, since it was lit by the radiant glory of God, and the Lamb was a lighted torch for it. We'll stop there. And again, God, in using the symbolism of the precious stone to portray a life to be into eternity, the glorious life that God wants for us in being saved in Jesus Christ. And how glorious it's going to be. There'll be no need for sun nor moon, because there will be no night there. And the radiant glory of God will be shining forever and ever. And if you people would like to come up and take a look at these gemstones that came out of the lapidary and do have the names of gemstones used in the Bible. Again, whether they are the same stone chemically as the stone to which the ancients attached that name, we don't know for sure.
In Revelation 21, why King James got 2 out of your 12.
Is that right?
10 of them all were different names.
10 of them were different. Well, I did a little study on
that. The Israelites, when they left the land of bondage, why they spoiled the Egyptians, and they borrowed of the Egyptians jewels of silver and jewels of gold. Borrowed. Could you go with this?
Yeah, I did a little study on the different translations too. But I don't think it matters. I know that in one text, maybe it was the one that I read where it refers to jasper. Let me look. I think that was in Revelations. What does it say about... I don't find it now. But at any rate, it refers to jasper as... It refers to jasper as crystal clear in one of the translations. And jasper, according to the mineralogy today, is the opaque form of chalcedony.
I don't think it's a stone.
And so that's why we are sure that in some of these, our translation isn't the same as what they were meaning.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Very good.